Welcome to the Kindle Chronicles, the Friday podcast all about your Kindle. I'm Len Edgerly, and this is episode 189 on Friday, March 16th, 2012. I am back home in downtown Denver, where today I did not have to stand in line for anything the way I did several times earlier this week at South by Southwest Interactive in Austin, Texas. Omar Gayaga of the Austin American Statesman's Digital Savant blog reports that 24,569 of us registered for South by Interactive this year. That's a nearly 27% increase from last year's total. So it was the usual madhouse at the Austin Convention Center and environs, and then some. I was, of course, looking mainly for events and speakers related to ebooks and digital publishing, and I recorded three short interviews for you on my Olympus LS10 recorder, which I had with me, and a portable microphone as well. You are going to hear an upbeat 23-year-old published ebook author, a publisher's weekly reporter who worries about how Amazon will disrupt an industry that her magazine has been covering since 1872, and also from this man, who is an expert on business books and the business of books.
What Amazon is doing is they're innovating in almost every space, and that's going to be scary to a lot of people, and it's going to start disrupting business models, and that disruption that they are creating is working.
In news, we'll talk about Amazon's 3.0 update for the Kindle for iPad and other iOS devices, how college students prefer to read books for fun and study these days, and whether a refurbished Kindle Fire might make sense for you. For tech tips, I'm going to talk Twitter for a bit, and I'm going to whine about the Wi-Fi capability of my Kindle Fire. In content, I'm going to pass along some reading tips that I picked up at South by Southwest, including the appeal of USA Today's app for the Kindle Fire. Amazon was right up to date yesterday by putting out a new version of the Kindle for iPad, iPhone, and iPod Touch, the iOS family of apps. It came out yesterday, which was Thursday. Today's Friday, which is the day that the iPad shipped. And I did receive mine this morning. It arrived by FedEx in time for me to get it fired up so that I could take a look at it and tell you a little bit about my impressions of it so far. The screen really is noticeably better than the iPad 2, and I could compare that because Darlene still got the old iPad 2 that I had. The place where I saw it clearly was when I first fired up Netflix on the new iPad, and that red of the Netflix logo just sort of came crawling out of the screen at me, and I, without even comparing it with the red on the iPad 2, I knew it was more vibrant and more red, sort of less orange or something. And when I put them together, sure enough, the new one really was better. And also the movies played a lot better too. I'm now looking at the New York Review of Books on the new iPad, and it's, the type really couldn't be any clearer. It's very easy to read. It does seem to snap better than the iPad 2, so the work that Apple has done on this new display is really noticeable. The update to the Kindle for iPad app I like because it mirrors the way that the Fire organizes material on it, so that when you go to Books on the Fire, you're looking at the cloud or the device, and that's the same toggle that you get on this new app for the iOS devices. So if you tap on Cloud, you're basically looking at your archives, but of course you're looking at all the books and vibrant colors of the covers. And then if you touch the device tab, you're looking at the books that you've downloaded. Then across the top, you can see all items, books, newsstand, or docs, so that you can drill into your content by those categories. This is something which I think was available before this, but you can set up an icon for your iPad. If you navigate with Safari, going to www.amazon.com/Kindle Store for iPad, and then you make a an icon for the homepage. What I've got is a folder for books, and so I just drop that in. This gives you the chance to have an icon that takes you directly to the Kindle store, set up in a way that looks nice on the iPad, and then you can also go there just by Safari as well. One thing which I didn't see in the press release, which I got by email from Amazon yesterday, but Eel Lake Stubblehouse was pointing out to me that subscriptions can now be read on the iPad. And I'm not absolutely sure that this is a change compared to the earlier version, but I was pleased to see that when I went to my archive at amazon.com/mykmanagerkindle on my magazine and newspaper subscriptions, under the actions, I could change the subscription so that they would land on the iPad, on the Kindle for iPad app. And I don't think that was possible before. One thing which is still not available for the iPad are the blog subscriptions. I think that's disappointing. And I think, about a year ago, Stephen Windwalker was told that that was going to be made available, and it still isn't. So I was disappointed to see that. One thing which Eel Lake pointed out is that nowhere on here do you see the word Amazon. When you on the icon itself, it just says Kindle over the boy sitting under the tree, and then when you fire it up, it just says Kindle using the same orange font that you see on the Kindle Fire. Maybe Amazon is it's as it gets larger and you see criticism of it for some of its practices, basically just because it's so large and powerful in an industry which is undergoing dramatic change. The Kindle brand is somewhat free from some of the negative things which get said from time to time about Amazon, so maybe they're downplaying Amazon and keying up the Kindle. In any event, this is a good new update for the Kindle for iPad app. Next to news, I was interested to see a story by Laura Hazard Owen at paidcontent.com titled "Most U.S. College Students Now Prefer Digital Reading." And this was a survey which was done of college students titled "Survey on Students and Tablets 2012. They polled 1,206 college students and 204 college-bound high school seniors. Among the findings, college students prefer digital over print for fun reading, 57%, and textbook reading, 58%, about the same for both those categories. And this was described as a reversal from last year when more students preferred print over digital. And this was it was done by the Pearson Foundation. So Pearson is a textbook maker. A quarter of college students were reported to now own a tablet, compared to just 7% last year, and 17% of college-bound high school seniors were reported to own a tablet, compared to 4% last year. 35% of college students who own a tablet also own, quote, an e-book reader or a small tablet device. Laura noted she wasn't sure what a small tablet device is. She was asking Pearson to try to get some clarification for that. Among the tablets, the iPad was the most popular, no surprise there, but I think the Kindle Fire number was pretty impressive. The iPad percentage was 63%, and the Kindle Fire was 26%, and the Samsung Galaxy Tab 15%. If you do that multiplication of a quarter of students owning a tablet and then 35% of that with an ebook reader, according to my math, that gets to about 8% having ebook or e-ink readers. So I think you can see some domination among college students of tablets, led, of course, by the iPad. She had a great graphic for this story of John Belushi. I'm pretty sure that's John Belushi. He's wearing a shirt, and instead of a specific institution of higher learning, it just says college on it. Finally, news. I don't think this is new this week, but I've spotted it, and I think it's worth mentioning that you can now buy a refurbished Kindle Fire for $30 less than the $199 cost of a new one. And this, I've never had a refurbished Kindle, but I would assume that it's a pretty good deal. If you go to the information about refurbished Kindles, you find that every certified refurbished Kindle is backed by a full one-year limited warranty, just like a brand new Kindle, and that if you need to have your refurbished Kindle replaced. It's the same easy process for that. I think everyone here knows that if you have a Kindle with a problem, it's pretty easy during that year and sometimes even beyond the year to have Amazon just say, well, send it to us and we'll send you another one. I guess if you sent a refurbished one, you'd probably be getting a refurbished one back. But that $169 price gets you down to a pretty reasonable cost for a Kindle Fire, which I bet is just about as good as a brand new one. They ship it in a new box and everything. About the only thing you don't get is the little card that gives you the quick start instructions on how to use your Kindle Fire, but that's not much of a difference. I've seen, you know, in the past when the refurbished devices get going, there's been suggestions that means a new device is coming, and we've all heard reports of new Kindle Fires coming, but I think that's going to be later in the year, and we'll, the Kindle Fire as we know it is probably going to be the device, I would think, I guess, at least until the summer. For a tech tip this week, I want to pass along to you a blog that I've been exploring, which has all sorts of valuable information about the Kindle and other e-readers. The URL is ebookfriendly.com. The site was founded and designed by Piotr Kowalczyk, a self-publisher, author of short stories for geeks, and a declared enthusiast of electronic books. You'll find a tips and more section where one of the tips I appreciated is titled "How to Use Twitter to Discover the Instant to Discover and Instantly Buy Kindle eBooks." Piotr, that's P-I-O-T-R, notes that Twitter can be a quick and convenient way to download Kindle books and start reading them in a couple of clicks on your device using one of the free Kindle apps. When you find a tweet with a link to the Kindle store, you can click on it and the Amazon site opens. If you're logged into your Amazon account, you can go directly to a button for buying a book or downloading it to a free sample. And if you want the book to land on your e-ink Kindle, you can choose that under Send to Wireless. Good site. Check it out, ebookfriendly.com. And you'll find kind of he's got an archive of tech tips and other ideas that you might find helpful. I'm going to do a little Kindle Fire whining here and say that it still seems like I have difficulty connecting my Fire to internet here at my home in Denver. The benchmark for ease of doing this is my iPhone or my iPad. Once I set up a local network and password on those devices, I never have to mess with them again. They just automatically go there. But with a Fire, it's not uncommon for an irritating X to appear beneath the Wi-Fi symbol at the top, and then I have to go to the settings gear, tap on Wi-Fi, and scroll down a long list to find the name of our network, which I've named ClareNet after the Yorkie Claire. For some reason, I have about a dozen listings for Royal Sonesta in the Wi-Fi network, so I have to scroll past those to get to ClareNet. Of course, it's working fine now as I'm describing it, but last night it was I was trying to show a movie to Darlene, Sliding Doors with Gwyneth Paltrow, and I just never could get the thing connected. If these problems sound familiar and you've done some troubleshooting with your own Kindle Fire's Wi-Fi connection, I hope you'll tell me about your experience. You can email me at podchronicles@gmail.com or leave a comment at thekindlechronicles.com. Time now for the interviews. In addition to scheduled speakers and panels at South by Southwest, there were many opportunities to socialize in the evenings. Since I was staying with my cousin Peter in the northern part of the city, and he's a terrific cook, I didn't partake of many of the parties. The ones I did sample were impossible for conversation because there were so many people jammed into such small places with such loud music. But one event was just the opposite. It was named Books and Bites, a reception hosted by Cave Hendricks Communication and Shelton Interactive. The room there was full of authors, literary agents, and publishers with free drinks and pretty decent hors d'oeuvres. It's where I recorded this episode's first two interviews with Daniel A. Cohen, a young author who, to me, personified the excitement of digital publishing, and Todd Satterston, a savvy observer of the business of books who also specializes in the genre of business books. I will let them introduce themselves, and then I'll tell you a little bit about my third guest.
My name is Daniel Cohen. I work for Shelton Interactive, but I am an author as well. Excuse me, author as well. I had a book called The Ancillaries Mark come out last year. My book, Masters of the Veil, the first of the Veil trilogy, just came out March 1st. So I guess that's what we'll be talking about.
Yeah, now tell me about the book and the series, the trilogy.
Absolutely. Well, it is a YA fantasy. what I saw in the genre was that it was all kind of cookie cutter plots, cookie cutter characters, cardboard stale, and I thought, you know, I kept reading the drama because I love the genre, and I kept finding the same stuff over and over, and I really wanted to write something different, and I wanted to put the time and the effort in. I didn't want to follow one of the, you know, just step-by-step kind of plots. I do like fantasy, you know, Harry Potter, Name of the Winds, David Eddings, anything like that. Love that stuff. So I thought about, instead of taking maybe the outcast character, who everybody usually takes, and bringing him into a magical society, I said, what if I took a popular kid who thrived in our world, and he got sucked into this other world, and he hated it there, and he struggled, and it was so much fun. You know, it was. What I decided, though, is I didn't want to borrow anything, like I said, from any of my idols. I respect the other fantasy authors too much for that. So I created everything magical from the bottom up, as far as the theories behind it, the games, the plants, the animals, everything, philosophies.
You created your own world.
Created my own world. It took a long time, a lot.
How long did you work on this book, the new one?
Well, this one was about 3 years in the making for Masters. The next one I'm about three-quarters of the way done with. About 2 years on that one, so it's been a while.
And this is, what ages is YA, or what's your audience?
YA, honestly, the funny thing that you'll find these days is that YA is becoming a genre for anyone. More and more people. It's just because the plots are complex enough that you don't feel like you're getting gypped, but it's also, they're simple enough that you don't have to think too much. Everybody is working hard these days. They just want an escape book. They don't want to really. And that's the thing. I love, you know, complex books as well. But there's just something to be said for a simple, fun, fast read that you can just enjoy and sink your teeth into, you know?
Well, now you're an author coming of age in the ebook era. So your book is obviously going to sell a lot on the Kindle and the other ebook forms. What's that like from the author's point of view? Are you as happy to see a Kindle sale as a physical book sale, or what's it like?
Well, any sale is a good sale. I'll put it that way. But it's good for the authors as far as the ebooks and the rights managements and stuff. We get a little bit more royalties for the ebooks.
Can you say, what is it, like 70% versus 10% on the paper?
It's not. Yeah, I think I'm making about 8 to 10% on the paper copies, and I think maybe it's not that much higher. It's probably 20 to 30%. Yeah, it's not too much higher. But our company, and I love my company, my publishing company, Spencer Hill Press, they have a little bit of a different model. I get to control the marketing budget as well, and royalties come out after the marketing budget, after the gross kind of thing.
Oh,
yeah,
see.
Right.
So some of the money that could have come to you goes into marketing
exactly.
The book, which benefits you.
But I do get to basically be in charge of the marketing budget, what's happening with that. And it's been great. I actually graduated with a marketing degree.
From where?
Binghamton University in New York. And so I've been able to put that to use a little bit. It's been great.
Now, you live here in Austin?
I do. I just moved down, I guess, about 2 months ago.
How old are you?
23.
Oh, you got a lot of books ahead of you.
Yeah, hopefully.
How are you reading books yourself?
How?
I mean, on a Kindle or paper?
Oh, you know, I have a Kindle. To be honest, I just there's something about the physical copy that I just can't get enough of. And I do have books on my Kindle, and I like the Kindle for a lot of different reasons. A lot of books that maybe I don't need on my library shelf, but I want to read, great for Kindle. But, you know, books that I really just love and want to have and hold and be able to give to people, I do like that for the physical copy. But I think there's a world, you know, it's a world for both.
Are you aware of the public highlighting where you can see if I buy your book and I highlight a passage and then five other people do, you can see six people highlighted this passage?
I was. Actually, you know what's funny is I worked for Barnes & Noble for a while, and I sold the Nooks.
Yeah.
So, you know, I got to, and that's what I was doing all day, every day.
Now, do they have that on the Nook?
They do. They have the highlighting abilities. I'm not sure if you could see them.
Yeah, I don't think they're public and shareable.
No, I don't think they are. But I know about, you know, that the highlighting aspects are pretty cool.
Yeah. I've thought it'd be neat for an author because it's like instant feedback of what sections of your book generated a lot of highlights.
Absolutely. You know what's funny is the reviews are starting to trickle in now, and that's exciting.
How many reviews do you have on Amazon, on the Kindle side?
You know, normally I just check Goodreads, to be honest.
Oh, okay.
Do you use Goodreads?
You know, I subscribe. I haven't figured out a way to use it. I just don't. How should I be using Goodreads?
Well, I can only speak for myself.
Yeah.
But Goodreads has been the best tool for me. It has been unbelievable.
As an author?
As an author.
How do you use it?
Well, you can use it in a bunch of different ways. There's the publishing company that has their page. I have a page. What you do, it's kind of like Facebook, but for people who read. So it's a great way to network, to send, you know, messages to readers. What I'll do is, you know, for people who review my books and have their views on there, I'll usually send them a quick contact through Goodreads. I'll say, hey, you know, I'm really happy you like my book. Would you like me maybe to do a Q&A on your blog or maybe something like that? We'll keep a dialogue open. And then just because it's nice to see some fans, you know, it's to actually have fans is an unbelievable feeling. And, you know, no fan is too small kind of thing. So, you know, I did an interview yesterday with a blog that just started up, real long, you know, 4 or 5 page interview. It was wonderful, though, yeah. And she was, you know, real happy with it. So
you found her on Goodreads?
Found her on Goodreads. Yeah. Yep. So
terrific. Well, I've been talking with a new author, Dan Cohen, and the book is Masters of the Veil. What's the sub? Book one of the Veil trilogy. Thanks a lot, Dan.
Thank you.
My name is Todd Satterson. I run a company called BizBook Lab. What I do is I work on business books and the business of books.
And you've got a book out yourself with O'Reilly. Tell me about that.
I do. It's called Every Book is a Startup. And what it's about is trying to bring some of the philosophies that the software industry's learned about how to introduce products into the marketplace. So agile programming methodologies, lean startup, the sorts of things that Eric Ries and Steve Blank are talking about that are very, very popular.
And you're doing creative things with the release of the book. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I mean, what we're doing is we're trying to take the same philosophy that we talk about in the book and apply it to the book, right? How do we take the marketing of the book and do the same thing? So what we're doing is we're releasing the book as a minimum viable product. We put 2 chapters out back in July, and then we asked for feedback immediately. We said, what do you think of the book? What should we improve upon? And we've been getting really great feedback. What's the next chapter you'd like to see? And every couple of months, we put 2 or 3 more chapters out. We slowly increase the price of the book as we add more content.
What did it start at?
It started out at $2.99. It's at, I believe, $7.99 now. And what happens is at whatever point you buy the book, you get the rest of the updates for free.
How do they come to you?
You buy it directly through O'Reilly.com. A lot of the other commercial ebook systems really don't support that updating system properly. So we're using O'Reilly for now. When we finish the book, which will be probably mid 2012, we're going to then release it like you would a traditional book.
To Kindle and Nook and all that.
Kindle, Nook, there'll be a print edition, yeah.
But if I buy it at O'Reilly now, I can get a Mobi version that I can read on my Kindle?
You get all three. You get Mobi, you get PDF, and you get EPUB. And it's DRM-free.
DRM-free doesn't scare you as an author?
Absolutely not.
Why not?
Because from my standpoint, what I care about as the author, and sometimes, you know, the difference between being an author and being a publisher, sometimes those things aren't always aligned. But from my standpoint, the most important thing for me is the spread of the idea. And if someone gives it to someone else, there may have been a lost sale, but in our case, you can't get the updates anyways. So I think it encourages additional sales given the way we've set up the sales process.
So from where you sit watching all this, what's your sense of the overall terrain and the role that Amazon is playing?
I think, for me, it's relatively simple. What Amazon is doing is they're innovating in almost every space. And that's going to be scary to a lot of people. And it's going to start disrupting business models. And that disruption that they are creating is working. They're finding more market power. They are taking more market share in the book space. And they are starting to then use that power to get better terms, to spread even further. And so, of course, there's going to be different parties that are going to have different opinions on that. I think it forces all parties in the publishing ecosystem to say, what do I have to do to change the model and start innovating?
Yeah. Do you think it would be bad for readers if the government dismantles the agency pricing model with the antitrust suit that's apparently about to be launched?
Yeah, I think the agency pricing model is just fine the way it is. I think, I really do. I think the power for publishers to be able to set price in this mechanism, I think it's been established in other markets already. I think I'm not sure I fully understand where the Justice Department is going with this. And so, from my opinion, I'm fine with how things work. And I'm not quite sure. Yeah.
Now, O'Reilly's got a pretty radically different strategy than other publishers, specifically on the DRM. Are they the wave of the future, you think, in approaching that issue?
Well, I mean, I think the way that I think of them differently, and there's other examples of this, is the fact that I think it's difficult in the market that we're moving forward with to be just a book publisher. I think what O'Reilly does continuously over and over and over again is they find a tribe of people that have a very strong felt need about a subject. They find the people within that tribe who have very high expertise. They amplify the signal of those people through books, through periodicals, and through events. So they bring that tribe together physically, they update them consistently, and then they bring deep dives into that material. I think you could look at the Harvard Business Review Press or group. They do that relatively well in the business space. I think you could look at Hay House.
What's Hay House?
Hay House is a publisher in the new, sort of the new age spiritual space. They do something very similar. They do periodical, they do books, they do events now where they bring their authors in. They just announced they're opening a film studio, a film production studio. This idea of producing a whole cadre of products for a single individual is very powerful. And I think that's really why O'Reilly is winning and being very successful, and why I think more publishers need to think about integrating rather than getting even. It's going to be about verticals, and it's going to be about serving the customer in lots of different ways.
Now, going back to your book briefly and the updates, if I buy one of the earlier versions of your book, how do I find out there's a new one? How do I get it?
Yeah, O'Reilly's got a really great system in that whenever an update is released, you get an email from them directing you back to your account. They sort of have a locker on your site saying, there's a new edition of this, download the new version.
Now, if I bought your book on the Kindle and I'm highlighting it, the new version would wipe out the highlights on the old version, I guess.
Yes, it is a terribly sad reality to the process that we're using. I've gotten feedback from customers on that, and there's no way to solve that problem. What we've decided to do because of that is actually slow down the number of releases.
How many do you expect to have?
We're on version 3 right now. We're going to do one or two more before we have finished book. I was going to move to a chapter at a time, and because of the issue you talked about, we're going to actually slow that up. It's kind of sad that the technology that we have can't support the distribution strategy, I think, would work well in so many instances.
It seems like Amazon has figured that out, because I received an update of a book from Amazon, and it said, here's the update, we fixed some errors, and your highlights will be maintained somehow.
Yeah, I don't know 100% know that. We're here speaking at South by Southwest. I've heard that there are some people that are coming up with solutions with that, and I'm interested to hear more. I haven't heard enough to say maybe they've got that solved.
Great. I've been talking with Todd Satterson, author of Every Book is a Startup. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The third and final interview that I want to share with you, I recorded with Rachel Deal, who moderated an excellent panel at South By on Sunday, March 11th, titled Publishing Models Transforming the Book. Rachel is senior news editor at Publishers Weekly, the venerable chronicler of all things publishing. Her panel included three other people that I hope to track down for interviews in future weeks. One is Molly B. Barton, global digital director for Penguin. Another is Jefferson Rabb, creative director for The Atavist, publishes nonfiction in a model similar to that of Byliner. And the third is Brian Altoonian, CEO and president of Wowio, which is experimenting with the always controversial idea of putting ads in digital books. I think this lineup gives you an idea of the breadth of Rachel Deal's connections within publishing. After the panel, I spoke with her outside in the hallway at the Austin Sheraton. I began by explaining that to her that listeners of this podcast tend to be Kindle enthusiasts who share a generally supportive or benign attitude toward Amazon, but I said that I know there are other less favorable views of Amazon, especially within the industry that she covers for Publishers Weekly. I was curious what her own perspective on Amazon is, and this is what she had to say.
Well, I'll say this. As a consumer, I have a Kindle, and I love it. I love the ease of use. Certainly within traditional publishing, there are a lot of complicated feelings about Amazon, to put it mildly. Definitely people are afraid who work in traditional publishing that Amazon is out to kill their business. I mean, to put not too fine a point on it. And that's the driving fear. The really interesting thing is that for publishers, Amazon, I think, remains their biggest partner, and yet they're also, Amazon is also their most feared and difficult competitor. So you have this situation where, publishers sell digitally and in print most of their books through Amazon. And at the same time, they feel that Amazon really is looking for a way to drive prices as low as possible, that Amazon's interested in selling devices. It doesn't really care about selling content. And that therefore Amazon really doesn't want publishers in the mix, that the most convenient thing for Amazon would just be if there was lots of content and they sold it all for as little as possible and made money on device sales. You know, I think that's an overriding concern, you know, a huge concern in the industry, and it drives so much of sort of the conversation. And I think it definitely, you know, it's a daily conversation. People are watching every day what Amazon is doing and what they're going to do. But, you know, again, at the same time, Amazon sells most of their product, so.
I'm sure Amazon and Russ Grandinetti, the content guy, is talking to Stephen King, talking to Patterson, trying to, or it's probably Larry Kirschbaum is talking to all these people, trying to land one of them.
Right.
Why might one of them decide to pick up an Amazon deal? Maybe there would be 70% royalties as opposed to 10, but what would they be losing? What do you think the calculation going on those big writers that I'm sure Amazon's talking to?
Right. And that's definitely something everybody's talking about. You know, is it, will one of those authors make the switch and sort of self-publish with somebody like Amazon? You know, is it just a matter of time, or does it not interest them? I mean, I believe publishers, traditional publishers, unquestionably deliver a service, whether you're Stephen King or whether you're a debut author. And, you know, I think the service they deliver not only is print distribution, which isn't something Amazon can really offer right now, regardless of what they say. That's one thing that's still huge. The majority of the market is still, it's still very important, I think, to get your book in, when I say print distribution, I mean bookstore sort of distribution. That's a huge thing that publishers deliver right now. And I think also the services, I mean, the editorial services, the production services. I mean, I think those things are often overlooked. I think that's unfair. I just don't think people realize how much goes into what a book becomes. And there's no question that publishers are very good at that. And, you know, and I do think in this day and age, publicity and sort of figuring out how to connect readers with books is very hard. You know, certainly somebody like Stephen King or James Patterson already has that audience. So obviously they're a logical fit for somebody who could self-publish. But, you know, I was talking to somebody at one of the big houses who put it this way. I mean, when they talked about self-publishing, and, you know, if a Stephen King or if a James Patterson was to go that route, there's just a lot of back-end stuff that they would have to deal with. And what this person said is, you know, have you ever planned a wedding? Have you ever done your own taxes? There's a lot of, you know, I's to dot and T's to cross, and I don't know that somebody wants to do that. You know, if you're Stephen King, there are a lot of headaches to think about that your publisher just deals with. You know, you write your book, you give it to them, and you know, and you do your edits, and then you go on your way. So, you know, if you're publishing your own book, you really are, you know, you're the writer and the CEO, and you really are, it's kind of, you're running a company in a sense. So you have to pay attention to a lot more of the sort of business elements that come along with publishing. And I definitely think that's a service that publishers provide.
Do you feel conflicted when you read on your Kindle?
That's a good question. I'm thinking about that. I've been thinking if I need to buy a Nook, and I don't know the answer. But
You switched to reading pretty completely on the Kindle?
I read a ton digitally, but I, you know, since I sort of cover the industry, I get a lot of galleys and that kind of thing. So I mean, I still read print books, no question. So and that's one thing I'm sort of fascinated about too, you know, as somebody who cares about the industry and also as somebody who covers the industry, just sort of how are people going to read? And I kind of believe, I don't think there's going to be any one way. I think there are just going to be lots of hybrids. And I think as more sort of devices come on the market and more models open up, I think there are ways, you know, I don't know, I read the New York Times so much right now on the computer and my iPad, and sometimes on my iPhone. I don't know, maybe I'm going to be reading the New York Times in some way that I don't know about yet because it hasn't come along. And, you know, I don't know, maybe I'll be reading snippets and, you know, and then I am reading the New York Times as well on Twitter. I don't necessarily think about that. So, yeah, I think, you know, I don't think print is going away anytime soon, but I think different devices and different models are going to serve people in different ways at different times.
As is usual with such stimulating conferences, I returned home with a fistful of business cards, and I'm going to pass along some scribbled notes on them to point you to some intriguing content ideas. At a session where I asked a question about what makes a good author interview and mentioned my podcast, I was approached by a couple of authors who had books to recommend to me. One was Mike Cox of Austin, and he has written The Man Who Wrote Old Yeller, Fred Gibson, G-I-P-S-O-N, Texas Storyteller. It's available for $3.99 at the Kindle store. Cox's biography of Gibson was first published in 1980 and then remained out of print until he brought out a digital edition last year. I've downloaded a sample, and it looks like a good read. The preface starts off by suggesting that we baby boomers could just as well have been named Walt Disney babies. Cox writes, "I don't know anyone near my age who did not wear a coonskin cap and play Davy Crockett at the Alamo, watch the Mickey Mouse Club on television, or cry at the end of Disney's movie Old Yeller." Well, you can count me in on all those counts, and in fact, I was living in the panhandle of Texas in a town named Pampa in the glory days of my own Davy Crockett outfit, which I am reported to have worn to bed a few times. I was so excited to have it. So this looks like a good yarn, especially if you love that movie that Disney made out of Fred Gibson's multi-million selling story of Old Yeller. Molly B. Barton, Penguin's global digital director that I mentioned, spoke about a separately run Penguin site. She's actually the president of it, and you may want to check that out if you're interested in genre fiction. It's called Book Country, and it's a social media-driven community devoted to genre authors and books. And here's the innovation. They don't limit themselves to talking about books published by Penguin. You can check it out at bookcountry.com. The site is described as a place to discover and share fiction. You'll find areas for romance, fantasy, science fiction, thriller, and mystery. Authors can share their books and receive feedback, which makes the site perform somewhat like an accelerated slush pile. That was a term that Molly used with a smile during the panel, but it's clearly more than that by the looks of it. One innovative feature is a genre map where you can browse members' books by clicking on any of 42 subgenres, everything from hobby mystery to comic fantasy to steampunk to medical thriller. I downloaded a sample from Daniel A. Cohen's Masters of the Veil. That was my first interview, and I'm impressed with the writing. The story gets going in a brisk, writerly way, beginning with a high school football game that takes a very odd turn. Having spent time with the ebook ninjas in Austin at Ebook Architects, I was particularly sensitive to a couple of places in Daniel's book where the formatting seemed sort of broken. One, unfortunately, was in the first paragraph where an extra line space broke the flow of the text as it appeared on my Kindle Fire. It happened again in the first chapter. So that's something I hope maybe he'll be able to fix in some updated versions, but the writing of it looked pretty good to me. I can also recommend Todd Satterston's book that he discussed in the interview. That's Every Book is a Startup. It's not as easy to download a book from the O'Reilly site as it is at the Kindle store, but I made it through the process and was able to load the book to the Documents tab of my Kindle Fire. The introduction begins with this provocative quote: "Book publishing is a 16th century technology based on a 19th century business model trying to survive in the 21st century." I have already learned in reading Todd's book what a black swan is, and I'm looking forward to finishing this challenging and inspiring manifesto meant to serve as an antidote to the complacency which he sees permeating the publishing industry. One of the great things about South by Southwest is that you end up meeting interesting people just about everywhere you sit yourself down. In my case, I was finishing up a meal at Stubbs Barbecue when I introduced myself to two people who sat down at the common table with me. It turns out they are from USA Today, which gave me a chance to learn that the newspaper once derided as Mac Paper back when I was a reporter is still shaking things up now by taking a particularly active role in social media. Mary Hartney is social media editor, and she was with Charlie Zold, who is USA's tech writer. Meeting them led me to download USA Today's app for the Kindle Fire, which I think is pretty well designed. It's better than the Condé Nast apps, like for the New Yorker or Vanity Fair, because it gives you the ability to change the font size so you can make the text look the right size for easy reading. The photos are well displayed, really well done, and there are occasional videos, and USA Today updates the content on the app all day long for free. I know from experience that it's often more difficult to write short than to write long, so the reporters presenting important news stories and the comparatively short pieces at USA Today tend to write with noticeable precision. So if you haven't taken a look at this newspaper on your Fire, you might want to check it out. Finally, in content, I want to let you know about a handy app that I came across at Amazon's Apps for Android store. It's named TED for the highly popular and thoughtful series of talks of the same name. When you load this free app onto your Fire, it serves as a directory for TED Talks by various categories, and you can search for keywords. I just tried searching for ebooks, and the top two videos looked promising. George Dyson at the Birth of the Computer and Clay Shirky, How Social Media Can Make History. I've got time for a comment. This comes from Dexter Smith, who's listening to the podcast in Honolulu. He writes, on your Kindle Chronicles podcast, you often ask your guests if they know of any research regarding the advantages or disadvantages of reading material on the Kindle versus reading the same material in conventional books. So when I saw this article on the Time Magazine Healthland section yesterday, I thought it was something that I should pass along to you. And I'll have the link to this in the show notes. The title of the article is, Do Ebooks Make It Harder to Remember What You Just Read? Dexter writes, the article points to a couple of early studies that tend to point up some of the negative aspects of ebook reading, but overall it is as inconclusive and anecdotal as some of your comments on the Kindle reading experience. The reporter, Maya Salavitz, agrees with you that more research needs to be done on this question. What I found interesting about her article, Dexter says, is that it tries to map out the parameters and direction these future studies should take. I think you'll see in the article there's some interesting focus on remembering things that you read. I've tended to focus on how attentive I seem to be when I'm reading on a e-ink book compared to a paper book. But this made me question whether I'm right about my preference for this compared to paper. And I like the idea that these issues are being stirred up for, or being queued up for possible research by others. If you have any comments, I've got some comments here I've been holding over, and I'm going to really try to squeeze things into a tighter container next week so that I can catch up with some of the good comments that have been coming in. Best way to leave a comment that everyone can see, even if I don't have time to read it on the show, is to leave it at thekindlechronicles.com, or you can also leave comments at the Facebook page, which is facebook.com/thereadingedge. That's it for this week. I'm still digesting the ideas I took in at South By. I'm grateful for the chance to meet people that I know I'll be engaged with in the coming months and years. This goes especially for Chris Kraft, a longtime listener of the podcast who sought me out by email on the first day, resulting in a fascinating conversation over lunch one day and coffee another about ways that I might be able to be using social media more precisely to expand the reach of this Kindle Chronicles. Chris founded Splash Media in 2004 and now serves as CEO of the company, which is based in the Dallas metro area. I also had a chance to meet two of the three ebook ninjas in person and to tour their home base, the offices of eBook Architects in Austin. Founder Joshua Talent was away on a trip, but Chris Casey and Toby Stevenson were fine hosts at a meetup that we had in downtown Austin and on my tour. I can tell you that the eBook Architects office looks to the layman like a beehive of hard work and creativity, all devoted to designing and formatting eBooks that satisfy the highest standards of quality. It was a great trip, and I'm looking forward to a return to Austin next year when I have a hunch there'll be even more representatives of digital publishing to learn from and to meet. My guest next week will be James McQuivey of Forrester Research, and the week after that I'll be talking with novelist Margaret Atwood about her new byliner fiction titled I'm Starved for You. You can support the podcast with PayPal links that you will find on the show notes page. That's thekindlechronicles.com. I've got several different levels of continuing support that you can sign up for, or one-time contributions, which are very helpful. And I really want to thank those of you who are already doing so. We've been getting a lot of activity, donated Kindles, and support for ebooksfortroops.org. If you're not familiar with that program, I hope you'll check it out. Ken Clark and I have been, we're well into our second year now of distributing used and new Kindles to U.S. troops, now pretty much strictly in Afghanistan. Music for my podcast is Ramonk by Eval Monagat on the Variations in Time Time, a jazz perspective CD by Public Transit Recording, courtesy of IODA PromoNet. This is Len Edgerly from Denver, Colorado for the Kindle Chronicles. I really appreciate your taking the time to listen to my podcast. Have a great day. Bye.